Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett. You are tuned into CorbettReport.com, and more specifically, that particular show that we do once a month here about the Geneva Business Insider with the Geneva Business Insider himself, David L. Smith. Of course, his blog is, wait for it, GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com. Of course, that will be linked up in the show notes, as always. And as always, we'll be examining the real news, making news in the economic world, and the news that the talking heads don't want you to know about. So, David L. Smith, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Great to be back again. Thanks a lot, James.
Well, I wanted to start off this month with something a little bit different than what we're often talking about here, something that is happening under the surface of the geopolitical game and the military pretensions that we see shaping up in Syria, and that is the underlying economic reality of what's going on in the region generally. And this relates back to something that a friend of this show and someone we've had on frequently calls Pipelinistan. Of course, I'm referring to the work of Pepe Escobar. And this is something that should also be familiar to those who have been watching my series with Sibel Edmonds and talking about Gladio B and the politics in the Caucasus region with some of the big players in Azerbaijan and other places. But this all relates back to the pipelines that are at the very heart of this region and extremely important for what we can understand is shaping up not only in Syria but other parts. And specifically, this relates to an interesting competing pair of pipelines, the Nabucco pipeline and the South Stream pipeline, the South Stream being the Russian entree into the region, and the EU is currently deliberating on whether or not to basically go ahead with the Nabucco or South Stream and put their money on board one or the other. And I've found some interesting conflicting reports from different places talking about these pipelines in exactly contradictory ways. The other day, oilprice.com had an article, "Politics Beats Benefits as Europe Favors Nabucco over South Stream." And then oilprice.com, just a couple days before that, had an article, "Russia's South Stream may have defeated its Nabucco rival." And then we have a different opinion over from Balkans.com, which has "Nabucco West Gas Pipeline Project EU faces same moment of truth in Baku analysis." Basically, there's a lot of politics going on underneath the surface between this rivalry of Nabucco and South Stream. David L. Smith, what's your take on these pipelines and how they feed into the situation in Syria?
Well, I think the underlying truth of every war around the world is economic interests. And the economic interests that come to the fore most regularly, obviously, are oil and gas. And what we're seeing here is we're seeing the interests of Russia and Iran being directly threatened by the interference of the other Western powers. Now, if you look, I can tell a story. A couple of years ago, I went to a presentation which was made by Air Vice Marshal Stuart Peach, who is the head of the UK's Joint Strike Command, who said there were absolutely no intentions whatsoever of having any kind of military involvement in Syria and no plans to that effect. Anyway, as he was only head of Joint Strike Command, which organizes the activities of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, he wouldn't have a clue. Now we're looking at a situation where, at the moment, the sources of oil and gas, let's take gas because it's the main driver in this particular thing. The main sources of gas come from Norway, which is a nice, stable country which doesn't pose any major problems. Russia, which has demonstrated its capability to turn off and on the gas in the Ukraine at will and have the German industry trembling. And now we have a rising input of gas from Qatar. Now, of course, we know perfectly well that the Qataris have been financing the rebel activities in Syria for quite some time, and this is well known to the UNHCR and many other organizations who are meant to be doing good and having their hands tied by the people who should be helping them. You have this. You have a standoff, and then, of course, you take the two pipelines. Well, the Russian one, which is designed to extend their influence, and at the same time, you have the Western one, which has caused problems all the way from the Caucasus and through to eventually to Italy or Germany or whatever. So you have all of this. These major interests, geopolitical interests converging on the state of Syria, which is nothing more than a puppet. And the trouble is, at the moment, you know, there are several thousand irrelevant puppets called the Syrian population being killed every week in order to perpetuate this war and pursue the interests of the two parties involved. And I have to say that from my point of view, the Russian position is much more honorable than the position of the British, because at least it's less hypocritical. And we are watching now an escalation where the Russians are arming the Syrian army with S-300 missiles, which are pretty nasty pieces of work. The Israelis are trembling at the prospect or getting trigger happy at the prospect of having a good excuse to do something to beat down on their neighbors again. And the whole thing is getting ever more grotesque. Then you have people like William Hague in the UK, who I think is one of the few politicians I actually quite like, who's in a situation where he prefers the escalation to a stand down. And now he's got more of an escalation than he would ever have wanted. So the whole thing is just drifting slowly towards, a pretty unpleasant end, especially for the people in the country who have absolutely nothing to do with this and who are already living under the heel of a pretty nasty dictator to start with. But I'm sure at the moment they'd be praying to go back to the days when Assad had complete power and they weren't being bombed every night by friendly bombs.
Well, sadly, once again, it seems that the people become the unwilling and unwitting pawns of these greater geopolitical power plays that are going on in the region. And yet again, the people are the ones that pay with their lives for this. So let's talk a little bit about this rivalry, this Nabucco versus South Stream. Which one will the EU endorse? Which one will they go with? And the interesting part about this is that economically, there's no question that South Stream is the better choice. It's a better option. It will cost less. It will be more effective. And there's already been huge problems and delays and price increases with the Nabucco side of things. So if this were simply an economic decision, there shouldn't be much of a decision at all. But of course, they want to try to lower Russian, stranglehold over the European continent and their energy supply. So that might be part of this political calculus. Who really holds the leverage in this position? Is it the Russians who potentially could have that stranglehold? Is it the European Union who can threaten, if you guys keep funding and arming Assad, we're going to cut off the South Stream altogether? What is the political advantage here? What's the calculus, and where do you see this going?
Well, that's an excellent question, which I really can't answer. But I think you kind of put on the table all the alternatives. I mean, what you have is Russia defending their interests and their power base, and it's not about the pipeline; it's what flows through it and where it comes from. So the economics of the pipeline are irrelevant compared to whether, you know, who has a stranglehold upon whom. And at the moment, I think the jury's out. But what is extremely clear is Russia isn't going to roll over and play dead on this. I mean, they are moving serious assets into the Mediterranean in terms of their military, their naval fleet. It's the first time they're in something like 50 years, or at least since the collapse of the Soviet Union. They're supporting Syria with the kind of missiles which make the Western powers tremble, because they know they're up against something serious. So I think the jury is out. I think it's a game of kind of seeing who blinks first. But those are the options. And when you get countries reaching a level where it comes down to the egos of the people at the very top of the power structure, you never know what the rational event may take place. The only thing you do know is who's going to suffer.
Yes.
There's a nice African saying that when two elephants fight, it's only the grass that gets hurt. And that's exactly what's happening.
Unfortunately, that is all too predictable. If you were a betting man, do you think that Syria is going to be resolved in the near future, or is it going to be continuing along this destabilized path for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think it is going to be a grotesque, never-ending story. I mean, if you look at the Western powers' ability to sort out their economic crisis, we're 5 years in and nothing's been resolved. What we're looking at in Syria is exactly the same thing, with a few guns pointing in the background, and I'm fairly sure that the people in the military don't want to start pulling the triggers on each other, but they're just cannon fodder for the politicians as well. But my personal guess is it will go on, and we'll keep seeing reports of another 10,000 killed and another 50,000 killed, and the ruined state of Syria will get forever worse.
Well, not a happy prognosis, but unfortunately, that's what we are looking at. Well, let's turn our attention closer to home for you there in Switzerland. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening in Europe and apparently the about-face that's happening right now on austerity, or at least if you're listening to Angela Merkel, that's apparently what's happening. Let's talk a little bit about the rhetoric that's coming out of Germany right now.
Did you say austerity or hypocrisy? I'm not quite sure. because I've seen Mr. Schäuble doing his imitation of Dr. Strangelove once again and trying to pretend that he's now become all lovable. It's very curious that this sort of nice, warm, gooey feeling comes from Merkel and Schäuble just 3 months before the German elections, where there are all kinds of conflicting interests in the country, where one people are saying, well, you know, we can't carry on brutalizing the rest of Europe with austerity. The others say, well, we should continue. The Greenpeace people are, you know, Merkel is a coalition that she has to keep together by a policy of appeasement. And that is exactly what we're seeing now. We're seeing rumblings of yes, we're going to be austere, but maybe a little bit less, but there again, not too much. So the latest story is they're going to be contemplating injecting, I think, 9 billion euros into helping Southern Europe. Now, if you take the 9 billion euros and share it between the latest figure of 20 million unemployed, it's a one-off payment worth 500 euros for every person who's been driven into the unemployment queues by the dominance of Germany in the currency union that should never ever have taken place. So the whole thing I find is disgraceful. And if you try and translate 9 billion into something meaningful, it is approximately 3 days of spending on the part of Mr. Bernanke of his 85 billion monthly amount. So this is meant to change the situation somehow in the Eurozone, whose combined economy is even bigger than the US's. The whole thing is beyond all kinds of a joke. And the source of the funding is from an organization called the KfW, which is a Kasse für Wiederaufbau, which in fact was created at the time of the Marshall Plan, the restructuring fund of Germany. And I had a number of years ago a very interesting experience when the wall first came down in Berlin, and I was involved in acquiring a company in East Berlin, just off Unter den Linden, and the biggest negotiations took place with the KfW, state funding. And their main concerns at the time was, well, you can have the property, which was worth a fortune, but we got 1,200 people on the payroll, so promise that you won't fire more than 100 a month. So that is the kind of environment from which the KfW's less glorious days took place. However, the money in the KfW does belong 100% to the state. And, of course, it's not leveraged. And, of course, they've got low interest rates. So basically what we're seeing is yet another scam, which is basically a 9 billion political contribution fund contribution from the German taxpayer to the re-election of Merkel and Schäuble. And all of the rest of it is just disgusting hypocrisy.
So this is a pretty transparent bribe, basically, coming just ahead of the German elections as a pretty transparent attempt to garner some political favor?
That's exactly what it is. Nothing more, nothing less. And in terms of financial substance, utterly irrelevant to the scale of the problem.
Well, speaking of the scale of the problem, let's put that into perspective for people. And I understand you had a recent experience with a colleague with personal experience of the economic fallout in Cyprus and the reality on the ground there. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we have friends who live in Cyprus in Larnaca. And the lady, a former colleague of my wife, is a retired UN employee, and her husband is a Greek Cypriot. And I saw them for the first time since all these events took place and asked them what life had been like. And it was pretty grim. The husband, unfortunately, has a knee problem, and finds it very difficult to get around. He needs an operation, but can't necessarily get it done now. And unfortunately, he had his money in the Laiki Bank, where he's lost 90% of his life savings. So having found himself in this dreadful situation, when the banks reopened, he needed to get money. But so he went down on the day he was meant to get his pension for the week, and wanted to get 500 euros because you're allowed to withdraw 100 euros a day, to which the bank said, no, we can only give you 100 euros. You have to come every day to get the money. So there he was, a client with a reasonable amount of cash in the bank, now being forced with two bad legs to prop himself up in a two-hour queue, waiting to get you know, get money which is rightfully his from the state which owes him the money. And I did ask him, I said, why the hell, how can you put up with this? And he said, well, what is the alternative? And I said, well, you know, why don't you contemplate getting completely out of the Eurozone and starting over again? To which his answer was extremely interesting. He said, well, you know, there are 40,000 troops on the Turkish side of Cyprus, and if we get out of that situation, who's going to come to our rescue if they actually come and invade? And of course, at the moment, we were just talking about Pipelinistan. Mr. Erdogan, who's turning out to be a very nasty piece of work altogether, has got far more leverage than a bankrupt Cyprus would. So, you know, what would the deal be there? Would it be the next European Sudetenland, or what would happen to Cyprus? So they're between a rock and a hard place. And as I say, you know, when you link that to Mrs. Merkel's behavior, the pipeline interests and the poor people at the bottom of the ladder, or he's not even at the bottom of the ladder. He's fortunate he has a pension and they have the money to survive. But, you know, this is European harmony and democracy. I mean, it's absolutely tragic.
Tragic and yet again, unfortunately, unsurprising. And yet again, the people are the ones who get crushed under the boot of the bankster-led system here. So again, unfortunately, no surprise there. Turning our attention from the Eurozone specifically to the broader European Union generally, of course, one of the big events of the summer will be Mark Carney, the former Bank of Canada governor / former Goldman Sachs executive, moving on over to the Bank of England in an unusual move. And what's your take on what this portends for the Bank of England and what's coming up next in the UK?
Well, it's been interesting to observe what's been going on in the last two or three months between Mervyn King and Mark Carney, because Mervyn King has actually started saying a few truths, that one should not be printing too much money, and you know, we need to start cutting back, and we need alternative strategies, etc. But like most people, in their last two or three months of power, everyone goes, yeah, and let's go out for a beer and wait for the new guy. So Carney is going to come in, and Carney at the moment, I think he's a lucky guy. I was with someone yesterday who knows him personally, who said he's also a very nice guy. But what he has managed to do in Canada is basically push the problem forward in an economy which was not in as bad shape as the others, but he's created all the problems that the other economies had 5 years ago, and he's left at exactly the right moment. So you've got a burgeoning, consumer debt levels, property bubbles, money pumped into the system in vast quantities. And, Carney has said, beam me up, Scotty, get me out of here. And he's come to the UK, no doubt, to do more or less the same thing. And as usual with central bankers, they say the opposite of what they plan to do. But there are no other tools available. Either you face the music, which nobody wants, or you print money. And I think the most likely thing to happen is there's going to be an attempt to copy the Abenomics or the Osbonomics, if you like, in the UK, with George Osborne's tacit support. Because I think at least if you compare Osborne with with Carney, Carney's a very smart, astute financial guy, and Osborne is a lightweight idiot. So we know who's going to be in the driving seat there. And, you know, we know more or less which cliff he's going to drive the car off. It's going to be Thelma and Louise in a Rolls-Royce and London business suits.
Yeah, well, the worst part is when you can see them stepping on the gas pedal and you know that the cliff is up ahead, and it's just that moment where you just kind of wait for the weightlessness that comes with the gravity-defying act. What do you think this is going to look like when it starts to play out?
Well, I think it's going to be like Japan. I mean, the issues, okay, the absolute debt level in the UK, at least the government debt level, it is quite a lot lower than Japan's. But, you know, in order to push the currency down, there's going to have to be an awful lot of money printing to weaken it. And we're going to get, an accelerating level of debt. And at some point, the bond market is going to break. The interest rates are going to soar. And it will be a pretty horrendous situation. Because eventually, reality has to hit. You know, as Ayn Rand very wisely said, you can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality. And somewhere down the road, not too far away, I think the UK is going to have to face that. And temporarily, yes, they'll weaken the currency. Temporarily, you know, they'll probably be exactly, which is go long the stock market and short the currency, make a lot of money, buy yourself a new Maserati, where I think in Japan, luxury cars have never had a better sales period than in the last few months. And that's going to happen in the UK as well. And then it's all going to come home to roost.
Well, speaking of Japan and speaking of the consequences of defying reality, let's talk a little bit about Abenomics, which is on the tip of everyone's tongue because it's proved such a stunning success. Look at the Japanese stock market. Look at the Nikkei index just skyrocketing, except for that pesky little 10 or 15% drop we've seen in recent days. And yes, the volatility on the JGBs is off the charts, but I'm sure that it's all going to work out for the best, or so they want us to believe. And the first sign that we have, the first quarter GDP for Japan, 0.9%, 3.5% annualized, that's a pretty strong showing for such a moribund economy. It looks like it's a raging success. What's your take on Abenomics and where things are going from here?
Well, it is a raging success. Look at all those Maseratis, Ferraris, and Jaguars and Rolls Royces that have been bought by the Japanese elite on the dying of their currency and the rise of their stock market. But all of these are nothing more than financial maneuvers. And all of the economies of the world are driven by financial influences now. There's no real manufacturing, there's no production, there's no high level of employment. It is all manipulation. So, I mean, my take on Japan, I think you've hit all the points on the button. I mean, which is not surprising because you live there, you see it every day. But you know, the volatility is staggering. The interest rates on 10-year bonds have gone up about 70% in a week. Now, then we have, the stock market diving as people begin to get nervous. And then the Japanese central bank steps in and pumps another $20 billion into the system in order to stop the decline. They're following the Fed and saying, how much did you pump into maintain the Dow this week? Oh, well, we'll do half of that to maintain the Nikkei. So it is... You know, it's beyond a joke for anyone who actually has a vague understanding of reality. It's unbelievable to watch these people playing these games. It's like they're in a parallel universe and they think they're the masters of the world, whereas they're not even on the same planet as the rest of us.
Absolutely not. Well, my own fear is that Japan and what's happening here really is the potential spark that could light the powder keg of the next stage of the economic collapse. And I see that with the Japanese government bond volatility, of course, the second largest bond market in the world, and a lot is riding on it, especially, of course, the exposure of all the Japanese banks. And the Japanese banking sector is notoriously precarious at the best of times. So the thought that they might be on the verge of a type of collapse could have knock-on effects all around the world. What's your take on how this might play out?
Well, I think, you know, if you take the Japanese banks, they've been bankrupt for 10 years and disguised it by applying the same policies as the Fed, which have failed to work. Now what they're doing is they're just trying to accelerate the process. But I mean, the really scary things about Japan are, as you say, this tremendous amount of government bonds, which are owned very substantially in Japan, but not completely. You know, there's about 2/3 of savings or major pension funds are lying in those bonds, and the rest is shared around between the Japanese stock market, which is minuscule compared to the rest of the economy, and you know, some foreign investments. Now, if I were sitting in Japan looking at my options as a pre-retiree or a retiree, I'd be saying, I'm looking at a government that's decided to destroy the value of my currency by at least 2% a year, and in exchange they offer me 0.5% interest on which I pay tax. So, you know, Japanese logic may be slightly different from the rest of the world, but, you know, plus one, minus three, everybody understands. So, you know, I think we'll continue to see people liquidating their holdings in Japanese government bonds. If they pile into the stock market is so small in relation to the rest that a 5% movement out of bonds into the stock market is going to have an impact of, you know, a 50% increase in investment in the stock market. So the prices there may go completely bananas still by people trying to, you know, squash into too small a place. I also think the future for gold in that respect looks relatively good, because people are going to say, whatever else, you know, it is a means of preserving wealth when my government has deliberately decided not only to tax me, but to steal wealth from me through inflation. So all in all, you know, I think the prospects, what the Japanese have done by these moves is really to put the foot on the accelerator towards their own demise. And I think the scale, you know, we can laugh or cry, if you like, at Greece or Cyprus or all the rest of it, but the scale of a collapse in the second biggest bond market in the world, and the kind of cash outflows that might give rise to, I mean, we haven't seen the start of the volatility yet, and when it really does start, there is no way that the Japanese central bank can keep it under control. So my views going forward are, it's going to be challenging times.
Well, that's the understatement of the century, potentially, and I hope we're wrong about this. I hope it all works out fine so that no one actually ends up suffering, but I cannot envision a way that this will end happily, especially because, as you note, Japan's debt to GDP is absolutely off the charts, and of course that's only sustainable because there has been such demand for Japanese government bonds from the Japanese public through the pension system, and that is starting to break apart, and the idea of insolvency in the third largest economy in the world is a frightening prospect. But don't worry, they'll cover that by upping the sales tax here over the next couple of years. I'm sure that will make everything peachy keen and increase the already dwindling domestic demand. All right, let's turn our attention finally to the gold markets and what's going on there, and what we've seen in recent months with the rundown in prices and the demand for physical gold in Asia. Is that increasing or decreasing? I guess that depends who you ask. Let's talk a little bit about these issues.
Well, gold, curiously enough, it is the fulcrum of everything that is going on at the moment. And everything comes to gold as being a currency which has got some real long-term sustainable value. And of course, that's very inconvenient to the powers that be, who want people to continue to believe that their paper money that they're printing with gay abandon is the same thing and perfectly safe. So gold has been perpetually manipulated. The regulators, most notably the CFTC in the US, who are meant to be watching what goes on in the commodities business, are complicit in ensuring the maintenance of the manipulation, which is being performed by the bullion banks, who most notably are people like JP Morgan Chase or HSBC or Goldman Sachs. So they're all directly involved in making sure that the market remains false. So you have the regulator complicit, you have the people criminally manipulating the markets by their concentrated financial positions, You have a government fully aware of the situation and either saying nothing about it or actually instructing the banks to make these maneuvers on their behalf. So there is only one source of independence when you see the entire system being corrupted like that, and that, of course, is the media, who are there as the fourth arm of government to protect the interests of the people by blowing whistles and telling the truth. And, of course, we've all seen what Mr. Obama thinks of whistleblowers and the consequences of telling the truth in America these days are getting increasingly high, ranging from suicide to long imprisonment terms, etc., etc. So we have a very artificial situation all the way down the line, and I think there's a beautiful illustration of it that came out with an article in Bloomberg, which basically said, you know, after this sort of spike in demand in the Far East, the situation was now under control. You know, this kind of short panic period was over, and, you know, gold would resume its descent into hell. And they were talking in particular about India and China. Now, in India, on the same day, the Indian Times, who of course know nothing about India at all, I mean, they're just the national newspaper, came out with an article saying it was impossible to get gold physically anywhere. There were queues everywhere. The government's attempts to, you know, impose a tax on the importation of gold were being unsuccessful because they realized that smuggling would take place. And anecdotally as well, you know, in China, the Chinese government are still encouraging the population to buy gold, as well as, so they're the biggest importers as well as being the biggest producers. So we have this complete dichotomy between the controlled Western media pandering to the desires of the banks, who provide Bloomberg, for example, with a very substantial percentage of their revenues in terms of advertising and many other sources. So we basically, you know, it reaches a point where anything to do with the Western world, you should completely ignore anything that is said. And, you know, you see all of this propaganda, and then what is fascinating for those who look a bit closer at the detail are what is actually happening in the genuine marketplace. Now, gold is traded on the futures market, and we have seen that manipulation can drive the price down through the floor by huge short selling of non-existent gold, because if the people, the bullion banks who are actually selling this, were actually a year ago asked to deliver any of it, they didn't have any. So now what we're seeing is this huge propaganda machine designed to do nothing else, I think, but to suck in the suckers who think gold's going down, let's jump on the short side of this deal, we're going to make a load of money. And then when you actually look at the positions that people have taken, where they're split into two basic categories, you know, what one is the bullion banks, who are called commercials, and the others are large speculators, who are people like hedge funds, and then smaller speculators, which are normal citizens thinking that they've understood the market. You'll see that the short position, which was held a year ago by the major bullion banks, has practically evaporated, and now the short position has all been dumped onto the suckers. The you know, strategic investors who in the hedge fund side, and the banks are more or less out clean. And the last little codicil to this is the fact that GLD, which is the biggest exchange traded fund in the world for gold, there is a mechanism where if you collect more than 100,000 shares in the ETF, you can go to the ETF and ask for physical delivery of their gold. So what has been happening is the banks have been rigging the paper price, driving it down, then going to GLD and withdrawing physical gold, and they've withdrawn several hundred tons already. And now if we look at their short position on paper, it's down to the equivalent of a couple of hundred tons, and all they have to do is crash the market once again, get delivery from GLD, and then they're completely out of their exposure on the short side. And then you'll never guess what they'll do then. All of a sudden, there will be a realization by Bloomberg and Reuters and everybody else that, oh my goodness, look at this. You know, the gold market may actually not have crashed completely after all. There may be a glimmer of hope. And by which time, all of these big banks are going to be on the long side, and the poor suckers are still holding on the short side are going to get massacred. And the people who have fraudulently manipulated the whole market for years are going to walk away with their pockets full of money. Or physical gold, depending on what they prefer.
So if I were to summarize all of that take in a pithy three-word statement, it would be, buy the dip. Would I be wrong in that assessment?
Well, some would add the letter F into that, just to say.
Buy the F and dip. I agree completely with that analysis. And let's just throw in the further fact that I believe central banks are even stepping up their purchases with, I think, 130 tons being purchased last month, mostly by Russia and South Korea, but by other central banks as well. So watch what the central banks are doing, not what they're saying, and watch what the bullion banks are doing, not what they're saying. And I think you get the picture. All right, David L. Smith, just a ton of information this month, as always. So for people who are interested in more about yourself and your work, tell people how they can find you.
Yeah, may I just add one thing before we get on to that?
Please do.
Congratulations on being a new dad.
Thank you so much.
It's the most important thing, I think I said my congratulation mail to you that you'll ever do. And I saw your broadcast with your little picture of your son's hand, and you're starting on the greatest mission in life. And the great thing about it, you know, my kids are older, but what you do in life is you transmit what you think and what your values are to them. And I'm sure your son's going to grow up to be a great little chap. And I wish you all the best.
Well, thank you so much. But my little confession, that was a stock photo because I'm not a good photographer. But yes, thank you so much for that.
Okay. Right. Yes. Geneva Business Insider. I provide basically financial advice, not direct investment advice, but financial and strategic advice to people. The website is www.genevabusinessinsider.blogspot.com. You can see me there. You can listen to my previous broadcasts there, many of which have been, of course, with James Corbett. And if you find what I'm saying is interesting or you feel I could help you, once you've had a look at my website, please don't hesitate to contact me. Thanks a lot.
Excellent. All right, we'll leave it there for this month. Looking forward to our next conversation. Once again, David L. Smith, Geneva Business Insider, thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.